The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, you are with us. This is Breaking Banks. We are live from the East Coast of the United States, and we have a great show for you guys today. Just if you didn't hear the news, we had an absolutely massive month in September. We doubled our listener base in 1 month. It just blows my mind. So, we were looking to hit 2 million listeners for the year, and we've just blown that out of the water. 140 countries now. It makes us the number one show on Voice America Business Channel. That's huge in itself. But of course, we retain our number one spot as the global leading fintech radio show in the world. It's just awesome. Thank you for your support. Now, before we get going on some of the announcements and so forth, let me introduce Mark Hochstein, who's in the studio with us. Mark, can you say hello to everyone?
Hey, Brett. How's it going? Great to be here.
Very, very good. Very good. Now, so Dazza or Tommy, one of you guys, we can hear some background noise there. So if you guys can just put it on mute for a second, we'll introduce you in a second. Mark Hochstein, for those of you that don't know, he is Mark. What's your official title? You're editor in chief, right? American
yes,
Banker.
That's correct, Brett. I'm the editor in chief at American Banker.
Fantastic. So we do a lot of work with the American Banker folks, and you're going to be hearing from them a lot more on the show, more news about that soon. But Mark's going to join us today as the correspondent from American Banker and participating in the show with us. So thanks for being in the studio with us, Mark.
I appreciate it. You know, people have always told me I've got a face for radio, so I think this
absolutely. I've got a voice for print.
There you go.
And I got that one from Ron Shevlin, I think. So thanks, Ron. Just a couple of quick conference announcements before Mark and I start talking about some of the news in fintech of late. January 18 and 19, it sounds like a long way away, but it's going to come fast. Next Money is hosting the FF17 finals, fintech finals in Hong Kong in January. It's Asia's biggest fintech showcase to date. I'm going to be there, as well as several of the Breaking Banks family. JP Nichols is going to be there. Rob Finlay is going to be there. Of course, he's they're both deeply involved in the Next Money stuff. You can find out more about this at ff17.nextmoney.org, and it's part of the Start Me Up HK Festival. And if you book your tickets today, you get a 50% discount if you book before November 1st. So, also a big congrats to Findeavor, to Jim Bruney, who ran the Findeavor conference this week. I guess we'll hear more about that from Jim. That's of course the Finovate tech and developer conference. So that went off without a hitch. So thanks to Finovate for their continued support as a media partner as well. If you want to join in the show today, don't forget to tweet us out at Breaking Banks One, or tweet me personally at Brett King is my Twitter page, my Twitter handle rather, and you can join us there. So, in terms of news, Mark, what was the news about Wells Fargo and what we heard there?
Well, yesterday, the news broke that Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of the state of California, is investigating Wells Fargo for identity theft. Most listeners, I would assume, are familiar with the broad scandal there, where it was discovered.
Yeah, Rachel did an impassioned plea on the show a few weeks ago as well, but yeah, we're definitely familiar with it.
So we all know that we had thousands of branch employees who were creating unauthorized accounts for Wells Fargo customers without their consent, without their knowledge. Almost 2 million accounts, credit card accounts, checking and debit accounts, and they've paid huge fines. Their CEO lost his job. They were raked over the coals on Capitol Hill. It's a scandal that won't die. And the new wrinkle is that the California Attorney General sees this as a potential identity theft case. And Brett, I think it's really interesting. I don't know how strong a legal case there is. Whether or not this fits the legal definition of identity theft, and it could be that the California Attorney General is grandstanding here. But you kind of have to set that all aside. She has made a very important connection here, which is that identity is a real key part of this story. You know, if you think about it, this is one of the starkest examples we've seen in a while of how broken identity is. This whole setup where we dox ourselves, all of us, every day. We are always giving out.
You're showing your techie roots there, talking about doxing.
Yes. I'm a repentant former technophobe turned tech. But we're always giving out. Essentially, it's like giving out the car keys to a stranger with every business transaction you make, and this is what can happen.
Yeah. So for those of you that don't know the term doxing. That's when you search for private or identity information about a particular person on the internet for the intent or typically for malicious intent. So this is where we see disclosures. Like for example, the WikiLeaks. You could say if it involved identity information, it could be doxing. But like releasing someone's social security number, for example, would fit into that criteria. We willingly do that ourselves, right?
Yes, essentially. I mean, even every time you go to a doctor's office, and the other day I got a flu shot, and they gave me this form to fill out, and they wanted my address, they wanted my date of birth. Why do you need that for a flu shot? Yeah. So, I think that a lot of people who have been on this show before have talked about there are some interesting solutions in the works. There's some interesting open source software projects. There are startups that are all looking to solve this problem. It's not an easy problem to solve. So I'm not under any illusions that this is something that can just, a switch could be flipped. But I do think that this is a wonderful. If anything good comes of this, it might be of this Wells Fargo situation. It might be that it galvanizes people around the identity problem.
Now, they also made an announcement about the stores, which they used to call stores. But
stores no more, yes. So for a couple decades now, they have, since Dick Kovacevic, their former CEO, since that era, Wells Fargo referred to their branches as stores. And it was sort of one of the defining characteristics of their culture. And after the scandal broke in early September, they decided that they were going to stop referring to their branches as stores. If you watched the painful congressional hearings, one of the lawmakers chewed out the former CEO, the then CEO of Wells Fargo, for using that terminology. And I think on the one level, you could look at this decision to sort of just take this defining characteristic of a company and just change it like that. Under pressure, you could say that that's a knee-jerk reaction, and perhaps it was. It's not very clear if you listen to their last earnings call. It's not really clear where they want to go. It's not very clear what the new strategy is going to be at Wells Fargo, which I guess is understandable.
Well, I think that they're still, I guess, coming up with a strategy, right?
Yeah. So, but on the other hand, you could argue that it's an outdated way to think about stores.
Yeah.
As you know very well, branch traffic.
That's an outdated way to think about banking, right?
Yeah. Branch traffic is declining and fewer.
I think plummeting might be a better, more accurate term.
It's definitely on the wane. And you don't have to be a hardcore fintech. You don't have to.
I don't talk about that very much, of course.
Yeah. But, I think it's still up for debate whether branches become extinct. I do see an argument that branches might serve a purpose as, at the very least, a place where you come in to complain when you have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, some people talk about branches becoming more like showrooms. Yeah. They could be more like, you know, the Apple store where you could just kind of go in for like, the financial product equivalent of the Genius Bar. But the whole notion that it's a place where you're just going to move widgets and...
But there's certainly, there's an identity crisis of sorts going on with companies like Wells talking about their branches. But did you see the data on the new unbanked figures in the United States?
Yes. That just came out from the FDIC. I was a bit surprised.
We went from 25% of U.S. households unbanked down to 7%.
Yeah, I mean...
That's a huge shift. Now, you know, this is very interesting. It ties in with this branch conversation. Given branches have declined in that same period, you can't say that branch density has any real effect on financial inclusion.
That's a good point. It could be that you do need some branches, but you don't need a branch on every other block like we have here in New York City. I think that if you talk to the analysts who follow the banks on Wall Street, you know, they'll tell you that they think the industry is pretty much overbranched. You don't necessarily need a branch on every other block. It is quite striking. The figures that
it's good news. I mean, I think, you know, this is a trend we're seeing globally now, but I think it's, you know, if you look back, there's got to be a correlation with the phone, the smartphone. I mean, you look in Kenya, you look in China and India and here in the US, and, you know, I'm going to say it again, financial inclusion is happening as a result of mobile access to financial services, not as a result of branch access. That's the big change.
Do you think that's the case here in the US, though?
Well, I think probably it's a combination of debit card, alternative financial services, but mobile's a strong part of it. Because there's been no other shift. There's been no documentary change in terms of DOC requirements for KYC. Branch densities.
I would assume that they've gotten more stringent.
Right. Branch densities decreased. Right. So it's not access to branches. So it's either that. The economy is improving and people are more affluent and they need a formal banking relationship, or the phone has made the shift, or a combination of those two. That's my guess. But anyway, hey, look, this might be a good time for us to invite Dazza and Tommy back on the show. Dazza Greenwood, who's the legal tech expert at MIT Media Lab, and Tommy Leander, who's the legislative aide to Congressman Schwekert. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Tommy. And Congressman Schwekert is on the House Committee on Financial Services. He's also on subcommittees on monetary policy and trade, and subcommittee on capital markets and government-sponsored enterprises. And Tommy, tell us what happened, over the last couple of weeks in respect to blockchain in Washington.
Sure. Yeah. So just last week, we hosted a bit of a roundtable discussion. With the emphasis on the folks around the table as opposed to a kind of what is blockchain briefing, which is sometimes typical up here, is kind of to educate folks. But we decided, Dazza and I decided, along with the Chamber of Digital Commerce, to kind of just get the room full of some experts and put the minds together and hammer out what we'd hope to be some, you know, workable definitions for blockchain, but also pull from business, legal, and technical experts in this field. And just kind of get everyone talking to each other. I'd met with a number of them, and Dazza had met with a number of them individually. It felt like a perfect venue to get everyone together to have a three-hour afternoon discussion.
So, you know, in Australia, we'd say Dazza.
One in America.
This
was the classic American kind of day of, you know, Mr. Smith
was in Washington
with a blockchain under the arm, and we had a great dialogue. It was the kind of open forum that you'd want. And you know, we use Chatham.
What is what does a blockchain under the arm look like? I'm trying to get a visual of that.
But it's thin. Ephemeral. it's connected. And what it looked like was, you know, it was interesting. It looked a little different depending on who was saying what it was and what a blockchain looked like, how it worked. We got a bunch of definitions. We had a lot that were donated in advance of the day on the phone. And we want to thank you, Brett, and your show for helping us get the word out about this. And it was successful. And then I think if you look at a website we've got here for the event, it's mit.edu/blockchain. You will see embedded in the first page there's some slides where we have the notes of the proceedings. And so you'll see some of the open questions and ideas for the definition of blockchain.
Oh, you've even got a slideshow on
smart
there
contracts.
As well.
Yeah. And so I mean there's a few couple notable things, and Tommy and I thought we'd just highlight a couple of them. One of them is it was brought up that the it really depends what the legislation is intended to regulate, and in terms of which definition would be appropriate, which aspect of blockchain would be appropriate. And it might be a bit premature at this point to get in too definite about a definition until we can see how things shake out in the context of a particular bill. And there's a lot of great dialogue, you know, playing that out in this kind of bill or that kind of bill, which we captured. And the other outcome was that contracts are really where most of the action is legally right now with the rollout of products and services. And so we actually at that meeting, one of the outcomes was to convene a third get-together between Congressman Schweikert's office and MIT, law.mit, which will be in the probably third, fourth week of January. It'll be our second annual blockchain legal intensive at the Media Lab, and we're going to do it as an open event so people can participate on Google Hangout and go deeper now into how to apply blockchain and define it and what clauses are appropriate in contracts if you're using the services or providing the service as a company. So it was incredibly successful, and you know, it was
cool.
Kind of
so that
you bother for.
Yeah, awesome. That's, I mean, congratulations on pulling that off, and we're glad we could be a part of it, you know, not in person in Washington, but supporting you guys with it. Now, the lessons of the DAO, the Decentralized Autonomous Organization, or DAO, and so forth, in terms of the emerging smart contract side of things, what do you think the grasp is of this potential for machine-to-machine based contracts and transactions in Washington? Is there a growing awareness of this?
You know, I speaking just here in Washington, with the formation of the Blockchain Caucus, which is no more than 3 weeks old and three members on it, I think the conversation is very, very new. We've got a number of members who are interested, and once everyone returns after the election, you can probably count on that dialing up quite a bit. So as far as the current conversations, I'd say it's pretty young at the moment.
So do you think the future president, do you think she's going to have a blockchain advisor?
You know, I couldn't possibly guess. It'll be fun to see how it plays out. I like the she insert there.
Did I make a slip there? Freudian slip. I don't know.
Brett, are you predicting a Jill Stein victory? Is that
well played, Mark? Well played. Yes. No. So that's great, guys. So look, keep us informed. This is really interesting stuff. You know, this the potential for smart contracts and the blockchain. We do have to see. We do have to see regulations change to allow this. I always made the comments about the DAO that almost if you take a jurisdiction like Hong Kong with the SFC in terms of regulation for investment and the way companies are set up there, almost everything about the DAO was illegal in Hong Kong, right? But, you know, because you can't invest in a company where you don't sign to accept the risk, where you don't have the risk of that investment articulated to you by an investment advisor. You must have the company officers take fiduciary responsibility for those investment discussions, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of those rules were broken, by the DAO. Now, you could say regulation makes it illegal, so you shouldn't do it. But if you do that, then you can't be a competitive economy in 10 years' time because you've got to allow smart contracts and smart companies like this, right? So it's a really interesting. It's a really interesting development.
Yeah, you know, so one of the consensus points, and there's a lot of different political and other opinions of the day, was we ought to be treating blockchain now the same way the internet and e-commerce was treated in the
yes.
90s. And so, you know, we pulled up the policy report that I think Ira Magaziner and others in the White House put together. It was the right formulation of kind of, you know, more or less hands-off, you know, allowing the industry to grow, gain experience, and then, you know, as necessary, you know, later regulation, you know, for demonstrated market failures or specific purposes. That seemed to be what everyone was thinking. And the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, a lot of the dialogue, like what you were just critiquing, is relates to securities law, but there's a lot of other areas of law. And I've got some students now that I think we'll look at in January their project, but like banks and others have regulated requirements for consumer notices at certain points, like before, I don't know, default or other notices. We talked a lot about how smart contracts would be a great way to ensure and to prove that the notices were sent and received at the right time, at the right transaction point or life cycle event in the transaction. So there may be real opportunities to actually better apply existing law through smart contracts, as well as it being somewhat unsettled with other areas like securities. So I think it's revealed a lot of good that's on the way, as well as questions and complexity.
You know, the whole principle of this is we get more efficient, you know, transactional platforms and more efficient, you know, contracting and asset management and so forth. But you've got to take the human out of it. You've got to take the human oversight and governance, unless it's code-based. And you've got to take signatures and, you know hard docs and paper out of the process because, you know, it's just unnecessary in an automated world, right?
Right. And so another great thing that happened was, I mean, to Tommy and his office's credit, the measure that they were putting forward was an amendment of the e-sign law, which is similar to Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, basically defining electronic signatures, records, transactions. When we took a closer look at that to see exactly the implications of including blockchain, it was very clear that the current definitions are broad enough to encompass having these automated transactions and these trigger points that were, you know, chosen by the parties. They certainly constitute valid signatures, or they certainly can. And so one way to look at it is take the signatures out. Another way to look at it is, let's just apply the existing law in the context of new technology. And we're good at that.
Yeah.
You know, we know how to apply old law to new conditions.
Yeah, and on that as well, on that point, Perry Ann Boring from the Chamber of Digital Commerce brought up that the other side of that also, which is some of the folks in the business side of this are coming to her saying, you know, while we're thankful that you think it falls under current law, we'd love some clarification or just an emphasis that says it indeed does count. And so we've got the fun both sides of the conversation there. Some would, you know, on the business side find it helpful to have that extra clarification, where some on the other side say it's perfectly already written in there.
You bet.
Awesome.
You know, that's why we have e-sign, by the way. E-sign is a clarification that electronic methods are sufficient, when many of us thought at the time that it was already pretty clear under common law. It was, in fact, very helpful and unleashed a lot of investment, so that uncertainties that that general counsels and others had were addressed directly by law. Maybe that's the case now. And so, really, Schweikert's office is doing a terrific job getting it into the public forum so we can make wise law. If people need certainty, it can be clarified in law. So let's
now. I saw, Tommy, that the congressman had was instrumental in the Jobs Act back in April 2012. Does he see potential for employment opportunities with this, or disruption of employment? Is that one of the reasons he's really interested in this, or is it more that he's, you know, that he, given his expertise on the Financial Services Committee, that this has more direct impact?
I think it's the financial services realm that he sees the potential. Most of the conversations here in the office with folks we bring in to talk about blockchain is themed around transparency and efficiency, right? So how can we increase the transparency of the government through this technology? And oh, by the way, how can we get some of the waste in government out by streamlining some of these processes? And that's where the fascination with the smart contracts come in. In government use cases.
Awesome. Well, listen, after all the madness of the elections have passed and everything's sorted out, we'd love to come down and interview the congressman on what he thinks about the blockchain as well next time you guys are gearing up for a hearing or a session.
Yeah, absolutely. He'd love it.
Fantastic. Well, Tommy and Dazza, thanks for joining us again on Breaking Banks, and keep us informed and let us know how we can help.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having us.
You're very welcome. Very welcome. So that's good to hear. You know, this blockchain stuff. Who would have thought just a few years ago, in 2008, when Satoshi came up with this concept, that we'd be talking about it at U.S. Congress? It's pretty positive, Mark. What do you think?
Yeah. Although you will notice that they say blockchain all the time. They can't say Bitcoin, though. That's still politically incorrect.
No, I understand, but you know, blockchain's definitely become bigger than Bitcoin. You know, if you look at the slideshare they have on that mit.edu/blockchain, you know, they're talking about smart contracts. They're talking about distributed ledger. Other elements of it. It's certainly gone well beyond Bitcoin now. The discussion of blockchain.
I know, and it's moved very fast and gotten very big in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, just while we're on that, I did notice on American Banker there was a discussion on where is it now? I'm just trying to bring up the homepage for you guys. A discussion on what it would mean for banks for a Trump victory versus a Clinton victory. But is there any consensus in terms of which candidate might make a better president for fintech, do you think, Marcus? You know?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think Hillary Clinton has actually used the word blockchain in one of her public appearances. So
I recall, yes.
Think of that what you will. Trump... Well, to the extent that Trump is anti-globalist, you could construe that as maybe not being so great for fintech. If you want to, you know, restrict the visas and ability,
yes,
you know, people and trade across borders. If you view regulation as an impediment. And you view Washington as an impediment to innovation, and you view Trump, this is not necessarily my view, but if you view Trump as a potential cleansing fire that will, and I think this is sort of the Peter Thiel view, that, you know, he will finally, you know, get rid of the corruption in Washington and get things done, then maybe I could see, from a pure fintech perspective, an argument for Trump. But Trump's a wild card. You know, he's sort of unpredictable, and it's hard. It's hard to say what would happen in a Trump administration from the point of view of financial policy. Hillary Clinton's a little bit less unpredictable, perhaps there'd be less. Potential for
maybe a bit more business as usual in that respect.
Yeah,
fair enough. Hey, so let's move on. We've got to go to a break, but before the break, let's introduce the guests who are going to support us for the rest of the show. We have Eugene Danilkis. I hope that's the right pronunciation. He's the CEO of Mambu. Eugene, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brett. Good to be here.
Did I get the? How do you pronounce your surname?
Danilkis? Danilkis. Yeah, that's Danilkis. Right. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. And then Tim Carson, who I got that one right, I'm sure, CEO of Premier Kenya. Tim, where are you calling in from?
I'm calling from just outside Nairobi, Brett.
Very good. Very good. And are you originally from South Africa, or where are you from originally?
Yes, that's right. From Cape Town. But I've been in Kenya about 20 years now.
Okay. Well, you still got a bit of an accent, dude.
You've got a sharp ear.
It's cool. So listen, you guys, we're just going to go to a quick break, but if you guys can hang around, we'll talk about some of the fintech scene that's happening in Africa and elsewhere in the world that you guys are involved in. Thanks for joining us today. Eh?
Great. Thank you.
All right. So, guys, you're with Breaking Banks. It's myself and Mark Hochstein from American Banker Today at the helm with us. He's helping me host the show. And we're going to take a quick break. Before we do, a quick shout-out to Temenos, our sponsor. And we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks after this this break.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Banking analytics combined with cognitive computing provides you the ability to segment your customers and know each one as an individual in real time. To learn how you can turn data into insights with IBM Customer Insight for Banking, visit ibm.co/transformbanking.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, you are with Breaking Banks. I am Brett King, your host. I have in the studio with me today Mark Hochstein. His Twitter ID is at Mark Hochstein, his Twitter name today. What's your Twitter name today, Mark?
I believe...
Bad Hombrestein.
Bad Hombrestein, yes. I remembered it was a couple glasses of wine last night into the debate, and it seemed like the right thing to do at the time.
For those of you that aren't aware of what the reference is in terms of that joke, it's because last night on the debate, Donald Trump said, "We have some very bad hombres. We've got to get rid of it. Got to get out of here," or something. So
it's an evening for bad hombres and nasty women.
Nasty woman and bad hombres. Yeah, she's a very nasty woman, that Hillary Clinton. That's what he had to say. So he dug himself in some hot water again. The consensus on the debate, well, you know, it depends whether you read the Fox News website or other websites, but he's still struggling. He hasn't put himself back in the lead. If you want to know about statistical models on the show, one of my favorite sites for this is a site hosted by Nate Silver called 538.com. That is the words 538.com. And I don't know whether you're a follower of Nate, Mark, but his current polls only forecast, or the nowcast is, and it's pretty similar actually, that Hillary Clinton has an 86.9% chance of winning the election if it was held today. So
It's been around 75%. I sometimes look at the prediction markets, the betting markets. They're not infallible, but I think that they at least show that an honest picture of what people think is going to happen. And they've throughout the years, they've had Clinton as somewhere between 65-75% chance.
Yeah.
So But you know what? A week is a long time in politics.
It is. It is. Who knows? Who knows what happens? All right. So listen. Let's get into talking about some tech. Not in the U.S. We are a global show, so we have with us two guests who have plenty of experience, particularly in the African continent. But also, we're going to talk a bit about South America today. So, Eugene, first of all, what's your background? Because you've started this business, Mambu, and we'll talk about Mambu in a moment, but what's your background and what drove you to fintech?
So my background is much more on the tech side than the fin side. Computer scientist, engineer by training, so from Vancouver, Canada, and spent the start of my career working as a software developer, team lead, as an engineer, basically. Actually, interesting enough, for a company that was developing the robotic arm on the International Space Station. You know, there's the Canada arm on the space station, so... Yeah. Yeah, our company was developing that and the software and everything. So I was working on as
that's
an engineer.
So cool. Did you go to install it personally?
No. So we were working on the software team, and they were working. They didn't give us a chance to fly up there.
That sucks, dude. Yeah, it won't be long. We'll have tourist based space travel very soon. But that's pretty cool. We haven't had a rocket scientist on the show before. Not a literal one, yeah. So a software engineer that works in on space stuff. So that's pretty cool.
That's right,
And tell us about Mambu. You call yourselves the engine for digital banking. So what does that mean?
Yeah. So after I got tired of the whole rocket gig, ended up studying in the U.S. and actually worked with a traditional core banking software provider. And we were basically working, me and my co-founders at the end of the day, worked with them as consultants, basically kind of exploring the new opportunities. This is kind of before fintech was a thing. This is 2009, so we didn't really have the fintech word to throw around.
But we some of us were talking fintech back then, dude. There's not many of us. There was a few.
Was the word floating around? Yeah, okay.
Maybe it didn't sort of come into the popular vernacular until like later in 2010 for sure, but yeah.
Yeah, so when we were kind of working with the traditional providers, we saw, you know, obviously like everyone was seeing the rise of smartphones, access to penetration to internet, of course, in emerging markets. And then we kind of saw what was happening in the SaaS industry. I mean, what Salesforce was doing to CRM, and of course, NetSuite's been around for, I think, 5 or so years back then. And we kind of realized that why isn't this happening in the banking space? I mean, when we looked at kind of emerging markets, there was, at that time, 2.5-3 billion people without access to financial services. Those people with internet and mobile phones, smart or dumb, eventually smart, of course, would eventually have access to financial services. Now, whether it comes from banks or it comes from fintech startups as it is nowadays or it comes from telcos, we didn't really know. But that was simply inevitable that they would have access to financial services. And what we thought the world needed then at that point was a platform that was a little bit more lean, more flexible than the systems that existed before, basically. Mm. So the idea was to really build something that was appropriate for servicing financial clients, basically with loans and deposits, but something that's kind of built up, you know, in the cloud world, really, in the cloud age.
Cool. Very good. So let's also introduce Tim, Tim Carson. So Tim, your business is more a bit direct to consumer, isn't it? Premier Kenya in Africa.
That's right, Britt. Premier Credit is we're active in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania.
Tanzania, Rwanda.
Our previous business, we were in Rwanda and South Sudan, but we're not active there at the moment.
Okay.
We have about 100,000 clients, all small business clients. We're a small business credit institution, we use Mambu to service those clients. We have about 1,000 loan officers in the field, and they all work with their smartphone directly into Mambu.
So how would you describe the Mambu architecture or the platform? Is it a bank in the box? Is it a bank as a platform? What's the correct word to describe it? Maybe Eugene, you want to start on that?
Yeah, well, I'd love to hear Tim's description of it as well, actually. I can give it a go as well. No, we think of it really as, I mean, as a combination, basically, of a core banking platform, a CRM system, and very importantly, wrapped up kind of in an API layer. So it's basically everything you need behind the scenes to design, you know, the different types of loan and deposit products you have, and then manage all your customer data around it, and all everything that happens around it, of course, the reporting, the accounting, all of that. And then I think most critically, having that wrapped up in a system that's completely configurable. So much like Salesforce, you go in there, you know, in Salesforce, you configure the application. Same with Mambu, you configure your products, etc. And then really importantly, in the age of fintechs, is having that all entirely API driven. So that it's very easy to connect it out to mobile services, to your customers, automated credit engines, to different payment gateways. I think the whole point of cloud and SaaS is about connectivity with other services and about empowerment of developers to be able to do that effectively.
So, Tim, for Premier Credit, you talked about mobile use in the field. What are your field personnel doing in terms of are they opening a line of credit out on the road, or what are they using the platform for?
Yeah, so every loan officer has a smartphone, and our loan officers go to the client. So we don't have branches that we want our clients to come to. So they go to the client's business, and if the client or prospective client wants a loan, they can register them using the Mambu app, register them in the field, take their photo, take their biometric data, take their GPS location, and fill out a loan application form on the spot at the client's business, which they then scan and upload. And through Mambu, their supervisor is immediately notified, and the supervisor can then approve the loan. And the whole process is then automated.
So can that be done in real time, or?
It's all being done in real time. I mean, they're generally...
That's amazing.
The internet connectivity in Kenya is very good. It's not as good in Tanzania and Uganda, so sometimes they upload all that data onto the phone, and then when they get back into an area with connectivity, everything will be uploaded. But certainly,
is that the Premier Express loan that you're talking about, or because I'm just looking at your website right now?
Speed is really what speed and simplicity is what we sort of sell as our defining characteristics in the marketplace.
So we had the Mshwari guys on a while back, and we've had the M-Pesa guys on a few times. Do you think that the success of, platforms like that has led to an expectation now of sort of instant access to banking capabilities? Is that part of because it's very hard even here in the US, and you can do payday loans, things like that, but getting access to a loan on like that in real time with that sort of onboarding is still tricky in a place like the US. So is that sort of that greenfield environment emerging in Kenya has sort of set the expectations because of these other platforms?
I think it has. I mean, obviously everybody uses M-Pesa and they know how quick and easy it is. So there's an expectation that things can happen quickly and simply. So we've set up our systems, and Mambu's enabled us to do that. As soon as the loan is approved, it goes into our interface with M-Pesa, that's uploaded, and there's just somebody in finance who just approves it at the end. So, from being registered within an hour, you can have your first loan with us, and then every week or every month, depending on what you've got to do, you get an SMS reminding you to make a payment, and you pay through M-Pesa, and it's automatically credited to your account. No human interaction at all. Although our loan officers will then use the smartphones to go to clients who haven't paid, or to remind clients to pay, because again, with the Mambu app, they've got that real-time data on exactly what their clients have done and if they've paid today when they were meant to pay.
Cool. Mark, did you have any questions maybe for Eugene? I guess not. Eugene, why Berlin? Why did you start up in Berlin?
One of my co-founders is German, and if you start a company in Germany, Berlin, of course, is the place to be. And for us, I mean, being so international, we have clients in 40 countries everywhere from China, Australia to USA, obviously parts of Africa. Berlin is a great hub for attracting talent from throughout Europe. I mean, out of the employees we have, I think less than 10% are actually from Germany, and even out of those 10%, most of them weren't even in Berlin. So we have a great international team that's being attracted from throughout Europe and comes to Berlin for that. And I think that's one of the most attractive parts for Berlin for us.
Eugene, this is Mark from American. Why has Berlin become a tech city? What about it brings those people there?
I think it was really, I mean, if you just kind of look at the history of the city, I mean, it was always, over the last 10 years, it started off being a cheap city, and that itself attracts people, especially freelancers and people who want to start a business, right? Because usually the first year, the first couple of years of starting a company, whether it's a startup or not, are always a challenge. And so being in a relatively cheap city gives a chance for some companies to get started. And of course, that then started to attract venture capital, that started to have some companies which started to grow. Those companies then started attracting other employees from Germany throughout Europe, and it's now just become a great international hub. And that system just started to build up that way, and now it has kind of the momentum around it. And I mean, even Brexit, you're hearing some companies.
Yeah, did you guys see that the Berlin guys had a truck driving around Canary Wharf, advertising that now that Brexit's happened, you should come to Berlin. Is the great advertising. That was very clever. It was clever advertising.
Yeah, and it's I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to see more companies starting in Berlin. And there's a lot of interviews also with London-based startups and companies talking about some of the executives there saying they're thinking of moving their companies. And I think Berlin was the top of the list if they were going to move.
Interesting.
And you guys just completed a Series B round for €8 million. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I started this year.
So congratulations on that. It's started this year. It's a fair while ago. Are you ready to raise some more yet?
Yes, for a young company, the start of the year feels like it might as well be a decade ago, actually.
Yeah. I've been there, dude. You know, we raised 22 million to date for Movin', and I can tell you, you know, it's raising the money's tough. But Tim, let me maybe ask you about the fintech scene in Africa. You know, where are the exciting locations in Africa for fintech startups? There seems to be so much happening in Africa.
Yeah, I think particularly in Nairobi, there's an enormous number of small little startups and incubators working in the tech space and building little fintech applications. And I think a lot of it has obviously been driven by mobile money and people have been building applications around that. So I think, Nairobi... Cape Town might disagree with me, but I'd say it's probably a sort of fintech leader on the African continent at the moment.
Yeah, what's your because how much work do you do in on the African continent, Eugene?
Right now, Africa is probably about a third or a quarter of our business or so. That's where we started off. Actually, our first few clients were in Africa, also Latin America, but right now it's probably about a quarter or so of our business.
And so where is that business happening? Sort of, you know, is it happening with startups in around Kenya? Is it in South Africa?
Right now we're just seeing a lot more. We're seeing actually exactly as Tim was saying, we're seeing more activity on in East Africa around the Kenya region. A little bit also on the West, Nigeria, there's Ghana as well, and some in South Africa. But Kenya for us, I think especially, it seems to be such a, I don't know, it's a hotspot for technology-driven companies, especially in Africa right now. So we're seeing a lot of those are like-minded to ours and see a lot of activity there.
Yeah, I'm going to Angola in I think it's January actually, so that'll be interesting to see what's happening there. So, and maybe might be down in Joburg in later in November. So don't know if you're going to be around, Tim, but I should ping you when I'm going down there.
Okay, great.
You know, in terms of how you guys see this evolving, Mambu, but generally Africa in general, you know, we talked about financial inclusion earlier and the issue of the branch and so forth. Of course, we know that, you know, branch density is low in Africa. How much is access to smartphones and internet access changing financial inclusion in Africa? Maybe, Tim, you start with that. How important is that from an infrastructure perspective? What's happened with the mobile?
Yeah, I mean, the smartphone is, you know, has enabled us to reach people quicker and more cost-effectively and to service them, you know, directly where they are. So it's had a huge impact. I think in terms of number of smartphone users, you probably find that it's still quite low as a percentage. Most people are still using simple phones, or the New Zealand call them dumb phones. So we've developed USSD applications to service those phones. But as the price of smartphones goes down, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of those clients move across to smartphones.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about you, Eugene? In terms of Mambu's development effort, how much of this is for enabling things like smartphone interactions?
And that was really kind of the main reason we started the company. I mean, where we see kind of the innovation around, let's talk about lending primarily, is really on the customer-facing side. So the origination, the journey of the customer, basically, of how they actually apply and get a loan, the KYC process, and then importantly, the credit scoring part, right? And that's where you're seeing a lot of companies innovate around that. Tim's case is actually bringing that out in the field using our mobile app. But we have a lot of other customers that are doing that by automated actual complete credit decision side of it, building better customer experiences through mobile and web interfaces. And like you were talking about earlier in the show, basically getting rid of the branch, because those are the sort of transactions you can do better through technology. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of kind of companies innovate around that. And in microfinance in Africa, they're doing that on the very small loan side of it. But you're seeing that happen in consumer lending. In Europe, you're seeing that happen in small and medium business lending. And it's the same sort of story, where it's about streamlining the whole entire process to go and better service a market that banks have effectively kind of abandoned. And it's, you know, it's the most organizations that are disrupting it, and it's true for the fintech companies, kind of start off in a market that's usually unattractive, right? That's the usual disruption story. So you start off by giving out micro, small loans. Banks figure, okay, that's not really particularly interesting. That's okay if we give that up. And then they move up and up the food chain. And one of our customers, Oak North, a bank in the UK, just recently gave out a £19 million loan to, I guess, a medium-sized business. So these organizations move up the food chain. They start off by doing, you know, micro. Now Tim is doing also SME lending. And they start to really move in that space. And that whole business is based on streamlining the whole process and automation around it.
Do you think that that's a common theme that's emerging, is fintech is synonymous with lowering friction and making things more efficient? I mean, is that what we're seeing globally, you think?
Yeah, I think it's about making things more efficient, and I think it's about making things less painful effectively. I mean, most people just don't enjoy the banking experience, and not that they really should. I mean, at the end of the day, banking is a lot of the plumbing of our economy. It doesn't have to be necessarily an enjoyable experience, but definitely shouldn't be a painful one. So they're making it streamlined, they're making it less painful, and they're making it something that's actually that's not a barrier for people to interact with. And so I think that's happening throughout the world right now, and that's why we have the customers everywhere from China to US and of course Africa.
Hey Mark, you know, do you think that there's an awareness that this is sort of the driving force here in the US yet? Do we do we have sort of an understanding that this that friction is not attractive in banking? Because it seems like some of the incumbents really still don't get this, you know.
Yeah, I think that the younger generation, the millennials, definitely have grown up as digital natives, and they're used to getting things right now. You know, they're used to getting information right away from the internet, and there's a growing recognition that the DMV like processes that we're used to in U.S. banking are not going to fly as that generation gets older and they have more money. An interesting question I wanted to put to Tim and Eugene, because Eugene, you mentioned KYC. I'm curious about what the onboarding process is like in
Kenya. How long does it take in Kenya to get the loan, Tim? To fill out an application?
Within an hour, if you've got your ID with you and we're able to register you at your business and assess your cash flow, it can be done within an hour.
Do you think you could get that faster?
It probably takes longer, but we can do same day. Could we do it faster? Our target
is it a regulatory constraint or is it a process issue?
No, it's not a regulatory constraint. As long as we can scan a copy of the customer's identity document and GPS his business location and be satisfied that he'd been operating there for 6 months. What slows us down as SME lenders. We're not lending sort of on formulas. Every single client is different. It's just assessing the cash flow and what he needs the money for and his repayment capacity.
Okay. So listen, guys, we're running out of time. Unfortunately, we've only got a couple of minutes left. So I just wanted to ask Eugene and Tim, how do people find out more about what you guys are doing? So first of all, Eugene, how do we find out more about Mambu?
Yeah, so obviously you can just go check on our website, mambu.com. And obviously there's some information on the website. Feel free to contact us as well, of course, through the website.
Fantastic. And Tim?
Yeah, same. Our website, premiergroup.co.ke. And all our contact details are there and a lot of what we do.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us today on the show, guys.
It was a pleasure, Brad. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. And Mark, we're going to be hearing from the American Banker folks quite regularly now on the show, aren't we?
Yep. Yep.
So you're going to be joining us regularly as a team of correspondents to help us. So that's great. So thanks for joining us today. And, keep us in mind for any breaking news that you want to put on the radio show as well.
Absolutely.
Are you going to be out at Money 2020 next week?
I will not. My colleagues from our sister publication Payment Source will be there in full force.
Okay, but
I will be at the Internet Identity Workshop in Mountain View, which I'm really looking forward to.
Cool. Well, I'm going to be out at IBM World of Watson, so we are going to be interviewing Watson himself next week, and also David Brin, a renowned science fiction author, is going to be on the show next week speaking to us from Vegas, so that's going to be huge. So, Mark, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Brad. It's a pleasure to be here.
And don't forget, guys, if you like the show, go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us out. That's the show for today. Thanks to Mark for joining us. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. I'll see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.